here's why I think that copyright protected works made by people is different to copyright protected works made by AI. But I'm going to phrase it to you like a question so you can decide for yourself, right? So if you think that creativity means that you read loads of books and then you regurgitate those books into a new book and that's your book, and you've only used the stuff that you have read and learned in the world, like, you know, all, and in some ways, everything, every word you've ever learned, you've learned from another book or you've learned from reading something else, right? And if you think that's it, that's the extent of what creativity is, then AI can do that. But if you think that creativity involves something more than just simply mashing up and regurgitating other songs that you know or other books that you've read or other films that you've seen, and it, there's also this extra kind of magical, spiritual personality, whatever it is that you think it is, something that like you can't point, you can't touch, but there's something in people where you add that extra essence of yourself to the thing that you make, then AI can't do that. And that's the magic of human creation.
That was Dr. Hayley Bosher, my guest this week, talking about what we're going to talk about in the show today, which is AI and its place in the creative process, especially within music. And I thought Dr. Hayley would be a great person to speak to because, one, she's recorded a podcast all about copyright and music, but two, she's just a great talker and thinker on all these things, and she's a proper expert in intellectual property. And I wanted to talk to her this week because, for some bizarre reason, during the budget last week, the UK government said this.
Today, with our talented Science, Innovation and Technology Secretary, I also take measures to strengthen our position in artificial intelligence, where the UK hosts one third of all European companies. I'm accepting all nine of the digital technology recommendations made by Sir Patrick Vallance in the review I asked him to do in the autumn statement. That means I can report to the House that we will launch an AI sandbox to trial new, faster approaches to help innovators get cutting-edge products to market. We'll work at pace with the Intellectual Property Office to provide clarity on IP rules so that generative AI companies can access the material they need. And we'll ask Sir Patrick's successor, Dame Angela McLean, to report before the summer on options around the growth duty for regulators. Because AI needs computing horsepower, I today commit around £900 million of funding to implement the recommendations of the Independent Future of Compute Review for an exascale computer.
Firstly, wow, that is a lot of money that's going into some very complex sounding computer things, and I'm sure the contracts are going to completely independent companies that have got absolutely nothing to do with this government, because they would never do that, would they? But the key thing in what he just said there, which I don't know if you picked it up, he basically said that he's going to allow it to be easier for AI companies to use creative works in order to create their products. So by that, I mean the input that goes in that allows the AI to create its outputs. That's not just ingredients. That's not just taking carrots and making carrot cake. That is taking all of the books, all of the films, all of the paintings, all of the photos, and most particularly to obviously this podcast, all of the songs, albums, stems, which is all the little sounds within every single song, that's all just going to be fed into machines. There has been pushback already from the creative community about the consent involved in huge companies like Google, huge companies like OpenAI who run ChatGPT, like what data they have access to, and then what they do with it when they create it. That's why I wanted to talk to Dr. Hayley Bosher today, because this all sounds very complicated and a little bit alarming. And I wanted to really understand it for myself, and hopefully everyone else can better understand it with my curiosity and stupidity of not knowing enough about how copyright law works, some of the precedents in law, which I might overuse that word in this episode. Before we start though, one thing I just want to say is the audio quality this week was not as good as it is normally. There were a few technical gremlins that we didn't notice. There's also a little bit in the podcast where you might hear an edit or two because there was a dog that was getting very loud and excited. But yeah, if you can hear a little robot purr, that is because I've used Adobe's podcast voice enhancer, which is a form of AI, to try and improve the audio quality a little bit, rather than it sound all echoey and glitchy. But it still sounds a tiny bit glitchy. Right. This is episode 007 of the Drone and Sound Podcast.
I'm Dr. Hayley Brasher. I'm a senior lecturer in intellectual property law at Brunel University, London. And basically all that means is that I'm an academic. So I teach and research in intellectual property law, and I specialize in copyright in the music industry. I wrote a book called Copyright in the Music Industry, which is aimed at people in the industry to learn all about the rights around music. And I produce and co-host a podcast called Who Sung Of It Anyway, where we also talk about music rights, music industry, and the most recent season is focusing on the experience of women in the music industry.
And how did you get into the law?
That's a good question. So actually, before I did law, I did performing arts and I loved it. I was having a great time, but I got to the end of the course and I was like, oh, I'm really poor and I need some money and I don't know if I'm really that good at this. I know, I'll do a law degree because that seems like there might be a job at the end of that road, having no idea what I was getting myself into. And I really hated it. I thought it was really boring. But I found entertainment law and intellectual property law in my final year of studying and was really happy about that because it was like a marriage of the two things where I get to look at the regulation and the rights around all the things that I loved and enjoyed. And so it was kind of quite serendipitous, actually. After that, I got offered the opportunity to do a PhD. And I was honestly like, what's a PhD? I have no idea. I didn't. And I think if I knew, I probably wouldn't have done it. But luckily, I had no idea how hard it was. So I said, yeah, all right, that sounds cool. And I did that. And that's how you become an academic, basically.
And so you're a doctor.
Here I am, yeah.
So for anyone who doesn't fully understand intellectual property, do you want to give a quick kind of few sentence-y kind of summary of what it is?
Yes. So it's basically these laws which govern all types of innovation and creation. And there's some main ones that you would have heard of, like a trademark, which is like a logo or branding for a product. Then there's these things called patents, which protects things like inventions and medicines. And then there's copyright, which is a type of intellectual property right that protects creativity. So things like books, music, film, theatre, soundboarding, broadcasts, songs, you know, all those kind of things.
And your whole first season goes quite deep into a lot of the complexities of it all. But I think there's two main copyrights in music, isn't there? The song and the recording. To what extent do you think that the complexity of copyright in music is different to other industries? Because I think, like, with literature, it's like 70 years after you die, isn't it, the copyrights like becomes open, and like there's something similar like that with music, isn't it? Do you want to just explain a little bit about how copyright works in music?
Yeah, so copyright law and the main principles of copyright law are the same across all those different types of creativity. So whether it's a book or music, you have the same principles of protection and regulation. But there are some nuances in the different areas. We call it, in the law, it's called a work. So music, the musical work has slightly different protection and nuances than, say, the sound recording, which in the music industry we would refer to as the master. And one of the big differences, as you mentioned, is how long it lasts. I think sometimes I resist a little bit the temptation to be like, ooh, it's so complex. Mm. Like, it's okay, it's new. And there is, you, if you wanted to, you could, like me, spend 4 years of your life studying deeply this complex level of copyright law. But I'm not advocating for people to do that on any level. I think as long as you understand that music is a type of creative work that's protected by this law called copyright. And yeah, there are two parts to that. So you have one copyright in the musical work, is the technical term, and that just means the musical composition, the song itself. And then you have another copyright in the fixed recording of that song, which we call the sound recording, and the music industry would refer to as the master. And those two rights tend to be owned by different people. So you can keep it quite simple and grasp enough information to kind of get a little bit involved in the topic without having to really get overwhelmed.
Yeah. And I guess the simplest way to think about it is like the start publishing music publishing style was sheet music, which someone else could perform the sheet music and be recorded. Because often the bit where I find it gets a bit more complicated is when you've got 8 co-writers on a song and then it all splits. There was a thing recently where one of the producers on one of the Rihanna tracks sold his rights as NFTs without any say-so from Rihanna or anyone involved right before the Super Bowl, and people buying it thinking they're buying like a chunk of the song, but they're buying a chunk of his chunk of the song. And there was a really in-depth kind of takedown of basically people thought they bought something worth hundreds of thousands for £300. And what they'd actually bought is something possibly worth £300 within the next 5 years, based on the calculations this person made. The reason I wanted to talk to you today was the government announced in the budget, Jeremy Hunt started talking about how there's this new fund for AI, but also they're going to make it easier for people developing artificial intelligence technology to use copyrighted material. So in a way, the artificial intelligence is composing music using elements of the whole history of music. So it can take all of the greatest bass lines of all time, and when you write a bass line that sounds like Prince, but make the texture of it sound like Talk, the AI can sort of do that in the same way, I guess, with all the visual platforms people have probably messed around with. My favorite thing that I've done so far with AI is I asked it to paint the cover of Joy Division's Unknown Pleasures in the style of Turner. And it made these beautiful kind of dripping paints, and it was all smoky. And it was like, okay, you've understood everything there is to know about Turner's painting and what he might do if he did that. So I think with music, it's a bit different. And in a way, the AI is a composer. So I thought the easiest way to maybe start talking about this is some of the big cases that have happened recently with like Robin Thicke and people borrowing from other people's work and passing off as their own. In a way, it seems, from what I understand of training data is how they talk about it, it just seemed a bit odd to hear the government say, we're just going to make it possible for these AI platforms to just use copyrighted material. How do you feel about that? And as someone that studies the law, is there even protections currently to stop any of that happening?
Well, you've asked a very dangerous... The way you framed the question, how do I feel about it? It's so dangerous.
Oh, yeah, sorry, with the law, I shouldn't talk about feelings.
No,
it's all facts.
Good, because I just mean that, like, I have a lot of feelings about this, and I'm going to get very animated when I express those feelings. But at the same time, I am a researcher, and so I feel that my opinions are based on my knowledge and understanding of copyright and how that works, and the copyright-based industries, music in particular, but I work in many of the creative industries. So I do have quite strong feelings, genuinely, about it. And I think that I am really concerned, for a start, with this approach by the government, that it's bizarre to me that the creative industries contribute so much incredible value to society in
Would you like a statistic of how much? So ISM, which Vic Bain, who was on the last episode, works for, they'd shared some research. So if you combine the aerospace industry, the life sciences industry, and the automotive industry, combine all three of those industries, which seem space, cars, I'm not totally sure what life sciences is. I'm guessing that's like pharmaceuticals and things. The music industry is worth, the creative industries is worth the same as all three of those industries combined, which is $115 billion in 2019. So as a contributor to our economy, the creative industries are huge. And that doesn't take into account things like people coming to Liverpool because they like the Beatles.
Well, exactly. That's the lowest bar, in my opinion, of what the music industry contributes to society. And it's a really high, low bar, right? So monetary-wise, we contribute a huge amount to the economy. But then there's all of this other wider contribution that music has to our lives as individuals, what music does in medicine and palliative care and sport and, you know, schools, education. Like, there's so much research that shows the benefit of music is like multifaceted, and we're only just beginning to really understand it. So it's this like economically viable / magical human thing. And then the government's like, oh, actually, let's prioritize this thing called AI, which we don't even, doesn't currently prove itself, right? It doesn't currently produce the kind of economic value or social value that the creative industries does. And honestly, in my view, I really feel like the AI has just become this like mythical thing that people think is going to do something way beyond what it will ever be able to do. Even in the word, like, think about it, artificial intelligence. The creative industries is about human people, not artificial people. And also, it's not intelligent. It's a pattern recognition software. It doesn't have common sense. It doesn't have intuition. As an academic, right, we're starting already to see students submitting assignments that are written by that bloody chatbot. And it's so obvious. It's not clever. It's so obvious that it's not written by a person. It's just nonsensical. And that annoys me on one level. But on the second level, I'm like, to what purpose? Who does this serve? Okay, you can get your degree certificate, but you don't know shit about the law. You can't be a very good lawyer because you've just made up this essay. Like, with this. And the other day, it's everywhere, right? The other day, I was in the sauna and there are these people talking. And the guy says to the other guy, yeah, I just used this AI chatbot to like write blog posts and stuff. And I'm like, why? What is the point? What are you contributing to society? You're just littering on the internet. Absolute trash. Like, what is the point? I don't understand why. I think if we just look at AI for what it is, pattern recognition software, it can be useful. I'm not slating all uses of AI. Yeah. It can do amazing things. It can really assist people in a process. It can recognize patterns when you want that to be, if that's going to help you with a solution or if you're dealing with big data, stuff like this. But when you're using it to create music, like you said, it's like, why are you doing that? If you really break it down, like, why would someone do that? And I really can't think of another reason other than to like save money. And I just think,
or save time. It's like the thing I found with photography is like stock photos. So with music, I think it's like library music. It's like, that's the kind of music it can make.
Where were we?
I was ranting about people using AI thinking it's some kind of genius thing instead of... I want people to understand that AI created... we're on a podcast.
Yeah, air quotes.
I'm doing air quotes with my fingers, everybody listening. AI assisted creations, I would call them, is way more accurate. And even calling it artificial intelligence, I think, is misleading. If we called it artificial pattern recognition software and dealt with it at that level, which I think is more accurate, then we would have a more realistic approach to what it does. And at the same time, I think it's really important for me to, anyway, that we recognize the social economic value that music, human-made music, brings to our lives, and we should treat that music with the reverence that it deserves on a legal, moral, and ethical level. These are two entirely different things, and I think that they should be treated that way.
There's this great Jaron Lanier quote where he essentially says that we make ourselves dumb to make devices seem smart, and we dumb ourselves down to be wowed by things. I don't know, are people wowed by calculators? Because essentially that's all what most AI is doing. It's putting a series of things together into a certain order. But the problem is, on a kind of ethical level, is if that information that's gone in has gone in without someone's consent. So the recording may have gone in with the consent of the record company, but the song itself is like the copyright of the song is the songwriter's. So whereabouts are there legal precedents? And whereabouts would you say that the big kind of flashing lights of
this is probably not great for intellectual property law to allow these training models or language pattern systems to take that information without the consent, I guess, of the creators.
Yeah, and that's an ethical and a legal problem. So first of all, on a copyright basis, the data that we're calling it data, but say it's music that's going in to the input and the training of the AI, it is copyright protected. And in order to make that use of that work, there should be a license. You should have the consent, or like you said, of the rights holders of that music to use that music for the purpose of whatever you're doing with the AI. And this is one of the things that has come up recently, because the government mentioned potentially creating what's called a copyright exception. Because currently, if you apply, I mean, there's everything about how the law applies to AI is a bit uncertain right now, because it's never been done before. So based on like everything I know about copyright law and everything I know about AI, I can apply it and tell you what I think would happen. But it hasn't happened yet. So a judge hasn't decided. So we're not 100% sure. So there's a bit of uncertainty, which gives a bit of wriggle room. But if you apply the law based on the principles, like you said, of not bloodlines, because that's an American case, and so we're talking about UK law, but same principles of like human copying of copyright music to the AI use of the data, calling it data in that instance, then you would 100% need a license for that. That's a use of the copyright work. You have to copy the work in order to do it. Copyright gives you the right to copy. You would need a license. So the government introducing this, potentially introducing what they call a text and data mining exception for AI, would mean that they could use that musical work without a copyright license, which for me is absurd. Like, why would you want to do that? Just get them, like any other businesses that use copyright protected material, they just get a license. There's no need for this. There's no impetus. There's no logic. Also, we sign these things called like the Berne Convention, right? It's an international trade agreement. There are 181 states that have signed this agreement, and it set minimum standards for things like all intellectual property rights, so we can like trade. And when you introduce a new copyright exception, it has to meet these three criteria. And as far as I can see, that AI exception that the government is considering doesn't meet any of those three criteria. The criteria, I'm trying to remember off the top of my head, is that it only applies in special, really like special unique instances. And the use of AI data copying of is not a special unique. It might be new, like, oh, we've never had this before, but it's not special and unique. It's actually quite typical use of a catalogue.
Can you think of an example of one of those special unique instances?
Yes. So a special unique instance of when you would want to not have need the permission of the copyright holder would be if you want to make a copyright work accessible to a disabled person.
Yeah.
So you print the words bigger for someone who is short-sighted. That's not the right word. Sorry.
visibly impaired.
Visibly impaired. Thank you. Short-sighted, not worrying about.
They could be short-sighted as well.
You know what I mean? So that's a really special, that's what you would call a unique special instance. And also the three things of the test, like they interlink. So when I tell you the other ones, you'll also understand why that's a really good example. The second one is that it doesn't interfere with the normal exploitation of the work. And again, licensing a catalogue for the use of copying and using it to create something else is typically what you would do. Like Spotify licenses the catalogue of like Universal or whatever to put it on their platform and do things with it. So that's actually the actual normal exploitation of the work. And the exception only applies where it doesn't interfere with the normal exploitation of the work. And then the third criteria is that it, essentially, I'm sort of paraphrasing because they use obviously old words. It's a really old thing. Is that it doesn't cause harm, essentially, to unreasonable harm to the rights holder, which obviously, again, in this instance, it would, because you can use their work for free where they would ordinarily license it. So they lose out on the license. It also, the output then competes with the ordinary exploitation of the rights holder's work, and therefore it would cause harm in that way as well. Whereas with the example that I gave you, like allowing people to use it where there's a disability, the harm is minimized. It doesn't, they, if the rights holder was already providing accessible, you know, like versions of their work, then you wouldn't need to do that anyway. Do you know what I mean? So then it's obviously not interfering with the normal exploitation of their work. And it's a very special meaning, like small, unique. Do you know what I mean? It's not something that's like they're saying, oh, AI is going to be massive and doing all these big things. It's almost like the opposite of small and special. So in my view, it's contrary to international law anyway. And not that that is like a reason to do on its own. You're like, it's a good legal argument, but it might not be a convincing kind of moral, ethical argument. At the same time, 181 countries have signed this thing, and we've had it for quite a while now. And we agree these like minimum standards based on what we all understand is the importance of intellectual property rights. So it's even on a moral, ethical level, rather than like focusing so specifically on the legal stuff. Do you know what I mean? It's contrary to what we're saying.
I guess I don't know whether you know this, but like, is it similar to the Universal Convention of Human Rights? And is this a Brexit benefit that they can basically not do what the EU is doing with intellectual property law? Like, is this one of their, have I found a Brexit benefit for people that don't want the copyright?
Firstly, it's not a benefit. But secondly, no, it's an international agreement. So it's not a European agreement. So when I said 181 states, that's all around the world. That's not only Europe. So no, it is not a Brexit benefit if there are any of those.
So say, for instance, me and you write a big hit song and the training data takes our track and Nigel Farage types something in, creates a piece of music and uses it for his next fascist ad campaign. We wouldn't have anything to stop him using essentially a sound alike, would we? That's, I guess, sound alikes are something which come up a fair bit in intellectual property law. So what right of reply or ability to stop would we have?
A really good question. And as I was saying earlier, we kind of have to like see how the law would apply to this new situation, because it's never been done before. It's never been a court case where this has happened yet. And I would say that there's basically two things we need to look at. The first is the use of the training data, use of the song in the training data, which in my view, according to the law as it says like today, would be an infringement without a license. The second part would be the output, like the new song that comes out the other end. And that's a little bit more tricky. And that goes back to the sort of blurred lines kind of stuff you mentioned earlier, and the Ed Sheeran copying case and all things like this, because the test for copyright infringement is not do two songs sound similar. It's whether you have copied a substantial part of the other song or not. And in law, the word substantial doesn't mean a lot. It means the quality. And the quality relates back to the human kind of element of copyright. And in the law, we use words like skill, labor and effort, intellectual creation, stuff like this. And it's all about basically all the skills and knowledge and craft that you've honed in making your music, plus like your basically you as a human entity and your personality coming through the music. And that's the unique part that's like different to all the other songs. Because in a way, isn't it pretty amazing that we have so many different songs when you think that the tools for making music are quite limited in the sense of like 12 notes? But there are obviously millions of variations of what you can do with all of that. So the problem would be that if we wanted to apply the test as it currently stands, you would have to point in the new song to somewhere where it's copied a substantial part of the earlier song. There's a good example of there's a Beatles song. Well, it's not a Beatles song, sorry. It's an AI generated song to sound like Beatles songs, where all of the training data was Beatles songs. And then the output song is called something like Daddy in My Car or something. You can YouTube it, everybody. It's so creepy and it's really horrid. But it's a really good example, because if you go and listen to it and you know the sound of Beatles songs, right? You can't, the new song, I wish I could remember the exact name, but it's something about a car. Maybe it's Daddy in My Car. Sorry, that's really weird.
Do you know the ironic thing is in this podcast recording, I couldn't technically drop that in without getting the permission of the person that created that piece of music.
Well, maybe you could, because there is a copyright exception called criticism and review, where you can safely use someone's copyright protected work for the purpose of criticism and review, which is what we are doing. And however, having said that, the technology would probably just block it. So everyone listening, go onto YouTube, because it is there, and type
I'll link
AI
to it in the description.
Yeah, Beatles song, and you'll hear what I'm talking about, right? And if you play the song, this new AI version, you're like, I can get this, is a vibe sort of a mashup of all Beatles songs ever. But I cannot say to you, this song sounds like Eleanor Rigby. This song sounds like Yesterday. I can't say that it's a substantial part of one Beatles song. It's a substantial part of the Beatles. And that's your problem with copyright law applying to this new situation. We don't have a law that says it's illegal to take a substantial part of a whole catalogue. We only say, because that's all we've ever needed to say, it's illegal to take a substantial part of somebody's song. And so you would have difficulty applying that now.
So how would that apply, for instance? Like, one of the big examples I've seen is in one of the photo AI generators, it started using what essentially looks like the Getty logo on the images, because the images that it's used in its system. So Getty have got quite a big case against, I can't remember which platform it is. It's either DALL-E or Midjourney or one of those ones. How would that, so the Beatles example would be a bit like if I used Andy Warhol as my prompt and it went and looked up, discovered what Andy Warhol's work was. And then if I said, create an album cover in the style of Andy Warhol of a kitten, it would then find someone else's image of a kitten and then mash that together, or 1,000 different people's images of kittens and mash that together to create a kitten. Like, whereabouts are the precedents? So is precedent even the right word? I feel like I'm trying to use legal language. And,
yeah, you're fine.
I've watched enough courtroom dramas to feel like I sort of vaguely understand the words I should be using. Whereabouts in other creative industries are there kind of better blockers to kind of taking it? So for instance, I guess with patents, that's a bit more black and white, is it?
Yeah, so the issues in patents are slightly different. They're really focusing on things like, can AI be the patent inventor? Yeah. If the AI can invent something. But the criteria for invention is different from the criteria for creation. So it's kind of a different question. The question about the Getty image logo is also slightly different, because the logo is a trademark protected intellectual property as opposed to a copyright. So there's also a different test there. And these copyright exceptions, they don't exist in trademark world. Trademark is what we call a monopoly right, which means you own the whole thing. You can like draw a circle around it. You're like, that's mine. You can't have any of it. And if anyone is ever confused because your logo looks a bit like my logo and therefore they think that we're somehow connected or whatever, then it's infringement. So in that sense, trademark's much more clear cut and quite much a stronger right, which you register for. Copyright is not a monopoly
right.
It's
a bit like we trademarked Drowning Sound, and someone had a site called Downed in Sound, which basically they just worked out there was a typo that was slightly shorter and they just registered a domain name. I can't remember exactly what happened, but I think someone wrote a very harsh letter and they changed the name of what they were doing.
Well, there you go. So in some ways, trademark can be a lot easier to enforce in that sense, whereas copyright's not a monopoly right, which is actually a good thing because of the nature of what it protects. What that means is if you and I are in separate rooms and we both draw a picture of a house and then we come and we show each other and the houses look extremely similar, if not, it could be exactly the same, and it's pure coincidence. No one has infringed anyone. That's absolutely fine. You have copyright in your version of your image and I have copyright in mine. Whereas in trademark, it doesn't work like that. Even if you do it by accident, you have to first check the register to make sure no one else is already using that logo. So it's kind of a different realm. And so the thing with the images where you said, like, do something in the style of insert name of famous artist or whatever, is that with copyright, it protects, and that here comes some more wishy-washy legal language, it protects the expression of an idea, not the idea itself. And this is actually a good principle. What that means is the idea of a romance novel or a horror film or a happy birthday song, these are all ideas, and we can all make our own versions of this. And we need it to be like that to encourage creativity and not be too restrictive. What you get is copyright protection in your individual expression of that idea, which is as lofty and weird as it sounds. That means that things like style tend to be in the idea camp, not the individual expression of the idea camp. But it depends, obviously. Look, I have to say that as a lawyer, at some point, everything depends. Because if you copied it closely enough to one of the, say, Andy Warhol, our works of art, that you could say it's substantially similar, or it slips into the expression of the idea part, then you could do it. But there's things like genre and theme and style. And this is why the Blurred Lines case was so controversial, because they said, the Marvin Gaye estate, who sued the Robin Kick and Pharrell Williams for Blurred Lines, the quote that always gets repeated is that it was the feel of the song that was the thing. And absolutely, copyright does not protect the feel of a song. 100% no. It's not supposed to, and it shouldn't, because the feel is definitely in the idea camp. Individual expression of the idea is like the arrangement, not the feel.
Yeah.
I mean, that
which is where the songwriting, and if they'd sampled it, would have been slightly different, wouldn't it? So
exactly. Well, a sample is so much easier. You know, the question of substantial, or if it wasn't infringement, it's obviously insubstantial. A sample is almost always a substantial part. And also, because going back to that thing you said earlier of the two copyrights, you would definitely need a license to use the master or the sound recording of the sample to do it. So sampling is a bit more kind of obvious. And if you think about it, AI created music is basically like loads of little samples mashed together to make a new song. It's just that it's not that easy to prove in court if you followed the current tests, which are based on human copying, not on AI copying.
So just to rewind back slightly, so the reason you can do a cover song of an original is because when it gets played, the original songwriter can get paid. But if you substantially change a cover song and create a new work from, so I'm trying to think of an example where someone is to change like significant amount of the lyrics, maybe changed the like, and then said, well, this is actually an original, and not paid the songwriter. That's where it gets a bit more complicated, isn't it?
Yeah, like that. I'm really uncool and I never know the names of people, but you know, the Miley Cyrus song that she's just done, it's kind of like a version of an older song. I want to say it was by Bruno Mars, but I could be totally wrong. Is that
I
right?
I love the idea that Bruno Mars is an older song. I'm not totally sure. I haven't come across
like,
this yet.
No, but like not a recent song.
Yeah.
The song is about like, oh, I wish I was a better boyfriend to you. And she's made a more recent like spin on it that's like, I buy my own flowers for myself.
Yeah.
Strong independent woman vibe. But you know, the lyrics are like a twisted version of the older song. So in a way, it's a good example of what you're saying. It's not really a cover, but it is using, it's clearly used that song as inspiration. If anything, it's like a response song to it. And the actual, the melody is the same, parts of the melody are the same. So two things. One, she's in America. And the law is different in America. And in America, they have this thing called fair use. And if you make a transformable difference with a copyright work, then it can be fair use. So it's possible that her version of the song is a fair use version of the previous song. However, in this current climate of everybody getting sued a lot for copyright infringement in music cases, I would hedge a bet that she got a license for it and that some of the royalty payments, or there's some agreement going on where she did actually clear the rights to do that.
Because that happened with Olivia Rodrigo in Paramore, I think, last year or the year before.
Oh, there's so many. I've got a playlist, actually. It's called Copyright in the Music Industry, and it's like days long of just songs that have been in copyright disputes. And it's not even exhaustive because there are so many. And every time I hear it, it's fun to look at. It's not fun to listen to, because one minute you're like Mariah Carey singing Christmas songs, and then the next minute it's like, yeah, Paramore. But you could look at it and see there are just endless claims, and they're all fairly recent. Like, the majority of them have come since Blurred Lines. That really had an impact on people bringing these kind of cases. So now people are really risk averse. Even if it would have been fair use, if she got legal advice, the lawyer would probably send to her like, oh, play it safe and just give them 15% and they'll go away, which isn't necessarily good for the legal kind of landscape and for the music industry, but people are nervous.
So what are the AI platforms arguing at the moment? Are they suggesting that there are arrangers and composers? Like, because I guess once they've taken in that information, then they try and release it. Like, I've seen one of the platforms takes like 20% of anything that's released created using the platform. There's one platform I found where it's created 11 million pieces of music that have all been uploaded to Spotify. And I guess all the streaming services, like, they still haven't created a hit. So the idea of a million monkeys can write a work of Shakespeare, like, that doesn't seem to have created a work of Shakespeare's sister. I think for any of the younger listeners and maybe outside the UK, Shakespeare's sister had quite a big hit in the UK in the late 90s, I feel like saying. Otherwise, that makes no sense whatsoever. what are they arguing that they are to have any exemption, or because there's no law, do they not even need one?
I think the AI business model doesn't currently fall in line with the ordinary copyright creative industry models. And as I said, because we haven't had any actual cases yet, and it's very early days in terms of applying the law, everything I've said is also just an argument. I would argue that the law says this and it would apply in this way based on what I know. But likewise, people can disagree with me. And if you're running an AI software music producing platform, then obviously it would work in your favor that you don't need a copyright license to do this, and your work that you've produced is not infringing. I mean, I would say that some of the work that they are producing, the stuff I've heard anyway, is like quite ambient music, and it's not really, I mean, we could go really meta and talk about like what's the difference between sound and music.
I've already got something planned on this podcast on exactly that topic as well.
I love it. And this does become like a conversation when we're talking about law sometimes, because how do we apply the law, all this kind of stuff. But just to keep it like fairly light, if it's ambient music, and it's just less likely to even be, not everything is copyright protectable, because if it isn't original, then it shouldn't be copyright protected. A bit like I was saying earlier about like, remember, if it's skill, labor and effort and own intellectual creation and all that kind of stuff, then that's the original part of the music. And if you're just playing the music game in the idea section of the idea expression thing, then you might not be creating anything that's copyright protectable in the first place, because maybe it's just all unoriginal. It's all very vague. Not different. So that could be a thing. I don't think they've really thought. I think they think that they're producing stuff that's copyright protected, and that I think we should debate that. I also, going off on a slight tangent, think that if we do decide, the collective royal we, that we are going to protect AI created music with copyright, I strongly believe that we should differentiate between human-made music and AI-created or assisted-created music in the way that the law applies protection. For going back to what you said earlier, that the law, for instance, is different lengths for certain different types of copyright protected work. So a sound recording has less than a musical work. And the length of a musical work is 70 years after the death of the creator. And that's, again, going back to that thing that copyright is really embedded in like the human creator. And you can't have 70 years after the death of the creator for an AI, because the AI is not a human who's going to die. Do you know what I mean? What is it, like 70 years after you unplug it? Like what? Yeah,
after the domain name lapses.
Exactly, it's nonsense. So I think that given the fact that it is less original and it's not making creative choices, it's only recognizing patterns, then if you are going to protect it with copyright, which I think is questionable in itself, but let's just say, then it's the copyright, the level of copyright AI created work should get, should be lower. It's less justified than human created musical works, in my view.
So would the way of playing devil's advocate and having one of those weird test cases be for us to create an AI platform, release a piece of music, and then demand that we get paid for it? Because in a way, you'd be trying to get copyright on something because you've created the tools to create it. I'm just like thinking, what's the like trying to create a copyright for a piece of work? Because I guess in theory, it would be 70 years after the person that built the platform dies, because they would argue, but have they built an instrument or have they built a composition tool? And if so, are they the composer? Because they've coded it. So it's that, like, there's loads of babushka dolls, isn't there, of like Russian dolls within a doll of like,
totally. Who is... I mean, I wrote my book on Microsoft Word. Microsoft Word doesn't have any copyright in my book. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. Like, if it's just a software, then it shouldn't have any copyright anyway. But you've bought
a license of Microsoft Word in order to create your book.
Technically.
No, you don't have to credit it, but like, but for instance, there's some stuff with fonts. If you use certain fonts, you're meant to like pay the rights and all those kind of, these are all things that people don't know. They're just like happily going around using stuff.
Yeah. So a font is a copyright protectable work, or can be if it's original enough. And also that crosses over into the whole trademark thing, because that's why people want an original font for their original trademark. Yeah.
That was a bit of a distraction of a point.
Yeah. Anyway, for the test case thing, basically what we'd need is two different test cases to happen, I think, to test all of these things we've been talking about. One, we would want an AI output to be sued by a record label for copyright infringement. Uh-huh. And then they would start asking all these questions. So that's one test case that we would kind of need. Or we don't actually need it to go through the courts. The legislator, the government, can just say, like, this is the law, this is what we're going to do. But in testing the current law, you would have a case and see how the judges apply the law. The second test case that we would need is for a AI-created work, someone to presume that they have copyright in it and then try to enforce that copyright. So a good example people may have heard, because it was in the news a few years ago, was this case, and it was about a photograph of a monkey, and the monkey had taken the picture of itself, and it was like this monkey selfie case. The photographer was a British guy called David Slater, and he said that he had copyright in the photo because he had arranged and set up the whole thing, given the camera to the monkey, and then edited the photo and then licensed the use of the photo. But in copyright, the person who owns the photograph is the photographer, i.e. the person who presses the button, which in that instance was the monkey. Uh-huh. And so this is actually an American case. And sometimes when people are talking about how we would apply copyright to AI, they use this case as an example, because the monkey is also a non-human creator. And so you could kind of see if it would apply in the same way. So in that, the reason why that case went to court is because Wikipedia uploaded the photo on their Creative Commons website. Creative Commons means out of copyright. And they said, anyone can use this picture because David Slater is not the copyright owner. It's in the public domain for everybody to use because it was taken by a monkey.
Uh-huh.
So if an AI created work was shared by someone on the basis that they didn't believe that copyright existed in that work. And then the AI producer, so the owner of the software, sued that person for infringement. It would go to court and the court would have to decide whether that work was protected by copyright or not. So anyone listening has got some spare time.
Yeah. So I don't know, say for instance, Netflix made a documentary about copyright and used a piece of music created by AI and didn't pay anyone any royalties. It would need someone to sue them for using, say, the sound or a likeness of. So say for instance, someone used that Beatles track, Paul McCartney would then have to sue Netflix, probably to create.
Not Paul McCartney, the AI software creator.
Okay.
So you would want Paul McCartney to sue the AI software creator.
Yeah.
Which doesn't work anyway because it was actually created by the copyright holders.
Okay.
I want to say it was Sony or Universal or more. But so that was one case. And then, but for the Netflix example, you would want the AI creator to sue Netflix, not Paul McCartney. That makes sense.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah. So the creator of the software, not the. You did say this wasn't too complicated, but I have a feeling for some people this might be getting a bit complicated now.
I think we're overcomplicating it a little bit. We've all these made up cases that have happened.
Yeah, so but I think that's often how the law works, isn't it? It's finding the like, well, this is an example of how this could work or not work. Going back to what the British government has suggested doing then of allowing people to use music and any creative works in AI products. Like, we've obviously talked through a lot of examples of how bad that can be. Is there any potential upside for us as a country to be, for basically to say intellectual property doesn't apply if you're creating AI using books and films and TV and scripts and songs and recordings? Like, is there any upside? I'm struggling to think of one beyond we might have some AI companies that we can, the government can tax if they're successful.
I'm thinking really hard because I don't want to seem like I'm totally biased. All I can think of is I'm like, you know, as the lawyer, you've got to be able to argue both sides. What I can think of, which is a really weak argument because I don't believe there is. Off the top of my head, no. I think everything I've said leads you to that conclusion anyway. Especially going back to what I said earlier about like, what is the point? What is it that the AI is trying to do? What are you trying to achieve? Are you making the world a better place? No. Are you just trying to make money? Then why are you even doing that? Because we've just seen from the data that the music industry is doing that already. Unless you're making it easier for the music industry to operate, I don't know what you're doing here.
Yeah.
You know, solve a problem for me, not create a problem. But some people, not everybody agrees that copyright's a good thing. And so they might argue that if we let AI program software developers use intellectual property and copyright protected works without permission, then they can create more things. And we'll just have like more creation and more culture. The reason why I think that's a really weak argument is because it might give us like a short. Was two things. One, it might show a short increase in the production of creativity, but question what the quality and meaning and insight. All that stuff I said earlier about how there's studies that show that students who learn a musical instrument while they're doing their exams will do better in their GCSEs, regardless if they're studying music, all that kind of stuff. Like, we don't know if AI-produced music can do the same thing because there's no, like, human intuition and emotion in there. It's just copying a pattern. But also it's short-sighted because it would increase the production of AI created works over the short term, but then obviously over the long term it would decrease the production of human created works which have a higher value,
or we just dilute it, which is what happens at the moment.
Yeah,
like there's two, I think I read 21 million tracks were released on streaming last year. Like, who's
what's
listening
the point?
To it? It's like an all-you-can-eat buffet that goes on to the distance.
But this is why I'm highly suspicious of this AI-created music industry. But we know, I spend a lot of my time arguing around the unfair remuneration for creators in music. This is not a lucrative part of the business to be in. If you want to create an AI record label, I see where you're going there. There's loads of money in that part of the industry. But like, I'm so suspicious of it because I'm like, this is already a saturated market. This is already an area where people struggle to make a living, generally speaking. So what are you doing? You're not helping the problem and you're not, I don't understand. Do you know what I mean? You've not gone into this and been like, oh, I'm going to meet a demand that's not being met. Or, yep. You know, I'm going to solve a problem or invent something or like contribute to science. Amazing way. I just don't really see the point.
Well, thank you so much for everything you taught me through. Yeah. I think I better understand it all now. Could you just tell us a little bit about what you've been, so you've got had 3 seasons of your podcast. I guess after people have listened to this, if they've enjoyed what you had to say, they can go subscribe. And do you want to just talk us through a little bit about what you've done in each series?
Thanks. Yeah. So basically, the first 2 seasons I co-host with Judge Jules or Jules O'Riordan, depending on your age, whoever you know who that is.
Not a legal judge?
Not a legal judge, no. I used to be a resident DJ for BBC Radio Workouts, so lots of people know him, but he's still a DJ. He produces music and also is a practicing lawyer in the music industry. So he's got great insights. I obviously know a lot about copyright law and work a bit in the music industry. And basically together we interview in the first 2 seasons all different people from different areas of the music industry. So you can kind of learn a bit more about how the industry functions, but also there's a real legal angle. So we talk a lot about contracts, like what's a fair contract? What's a song split? How does music copyright work? And then some of different things, like I touched on fair remuneration. We talk about the streaming inquiry, all sorts of stuff like this. We talk about NFTs. How does that work in terms of the legal side of it? And yeah, it was really good fun. We interviewed lots of different people, like representing different sectors of the music industry, some performers, singers, songwriters, and also some executive people. So that was really fun. And it basically came off the back of my book, which was released during lockdown. I couldn't do a book launch. And I thought, oh, I'll do a podcast instead. Yeah. That'd be quite fun. And then this season is slightly different. So in the new season, I've decided instead to focus on women in the music industry. So I interview these incredible women from the music industry who are also from all areas. There's some singers, performers, there's some women in positions of leadership, representative organizations, all these kind of things. And they share their experience of being a woman. Also, I have a non-binary person as well, talk about their experience of working in the music industry as a non-binary person and as women in the music industry, the challenges that they face. There is also a lot of discussion around how we can overcome those challenges as individuals and as an industry as a whole. And so it seeks to kind of raise those voices, think about solutions, and celebrate women in the music industry.
Great. Well, I've been enjoying I've been listening to a few of them before I spoke to you, so it's a great listen. And it's called?
It's called Whose Song Is It Anyway? And it's available on podcast platforms.
Great. Well, thank you so much for your time. Is there anything we haven't covered that we were meant to? I don't think so.
I don't think so. Sorry about the ranting about AI, because I know that AI does do magical things in, like, you know, medicine. You know, I'm not saying all AI is useless. I just genuinely think that we should sometimes consider the purpose of these things, because I think it's weird that people think it's a solution to something that's not a problem. The problem is not, we don't have enough music. The problem is people aren't getting paid for their music, you know, or we don't have good data in the music industry. We've got loads of problems in the music industry that AI could help us solve. Making music is not one of them. We've got that down. People can do it.